I want to start with this week's Parsha Vayikra. We begin a new sefer, a new book, and I know for most people, I'm not going to make assumptions for any particular individual, but I think there's a typical, I don't know, maybe like a groan, I'd say, is a typical response to Vayikra, because it's not the funnest book. It's not about stories, and the details that we learn are rather technical. They're rather specific about versions of killing animals, of sacrifices. I'll tell you exactly what page to go to. Don't worry about it. The details are rather technical, and perhaps more than anything else, it's not really relatable. We don't have sacrifices nowadays. And I think we don't really have an intuition about what would happen. I think back then, if you offer sacrifices, there'd be a little bit more of an intuition about it. And let me explain a little bit what I mean by that. What I want to talk about is a specific type of sacrifice today, and I want to first introduce why I think it's so important to really talk about sacrifices. Because the way that we give sacrifices, we kind of learn through Sefer Vayikra almost very surface level. And so even if you learn Vayikra well, what do? So you spend time talking about a chatah has these details, you happen to give it, in this way, these animals, and you slaughter the animal in this particular way, and this way you do it with the blood. It's very technical, and it feels almost very dry. And then same thing for an olah, it's very dry, detail-oriented. But the truth is, there's something much more significant going on. This is something that many modern commentators have pointed out. If you think about it, a korban ultimately have different purposes. But at some point, the basic agreement by all commentaries is a korban is some type of gesture to God. What exactly it is there some debate, but it's some type of statement. Whether I'm giving of myself, I'm giving a gift, something I'm doing for God. And not all gestures are the same, right? I can respond to God in different ways. And so the question between the different korbanot is, what type of gesture am I offering? Let me give you two just analogies to make this a little bit clearer. First off, I'll give you a story. Just a few weeks ago, a congregant from the shul came over to me and told me that a family member of theirs was going to have a medical procedure. Thank God, I'll tell you that it went very well. But the person in advance was asking me what to say. Is there like anything like specific text or Tehillim to recite? And so I could tell them the generic Tehillim. I could give them a list of like the common Tehillim, the ones we say every day. The generic, very common prayers, which is certainly, acceptable, great, it's effective, it works, God hears those prayers. But part of me was responding, why give only generic Tehillim, like psalms that are just about, God save us or listen to us. Why don't there are 150 different psalms. Let's find the ones which are specific to sickness, to God being the healer, right? Give something more specific to the need. And I think the same thing is true by korbanot, right? When we pray to God, right? So yes, it's true that we have kind of a generic davening that's the same every day. But if you pray the same way, right, you're not really praying. Like, obviously some days, right, I assume, most days it's hard necessarily to pray. But like once in a while, something comes up in your life and you just feel the need to pray. Like it happens to all of us. You have those days where something happened and you're very thankful to God, maybe you're praying for something in your career, in your job, or your family, right? There's something that makes your prayer a little bit different than how you usually pray. And so what you're thinking about changes as a result. And so in a world of korbanot, we would expect then that different korbanot, different sacrifices, would express themselves as different type of prayers, as different types of gestures. Let me give you a second analogy to make this clear. Let me get another chair. I'm going to pause for that. Let me get another chair from the around the top.
It's 1 minute. I think we have 1 minute, right?
Yeah, I think it's part of the happening portion.
Okay. I have a question, Rabbi.
Sure.
What about your own prayer that you say to Hashem, even in English, that you say, how does that weigh with saying Tehillim?
You're saying the comparative value of them?
Good question. Good question.
There is a reason that prayer is, formulated the way it is. It's sometimes difficult to understand because it feels very formulaic and feels very standardized. But It's a whole class in and of itself why prayer is standardized in that way, and I'll give you just like the 2-minute response, even though I think it really deserves a lot more time. But the short of it is that very intentionally the rabbis created this format that's mandated, you know, the same exact standard format, because number one, it kind of creates a baseline that everyone, you have to have this type of baseline every day, and the whole community as a whole is reciting the same thing, which has a certain, you know, unity to it that can be added to, but certainly kind of creates a baseline. And two, the prayer is created in a way that it's supposed to fill kind of like the whole wide gamut of what prayer is supposed to look like. And so if you were to come up with your own prayer, you might only focus on one particular aspect instead of the wide gamut of requests of God, you know, that cover all the different types of things.
Does it have any value?
Tehillim? Or
no. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Hannah, I thought, changed how we pray. Like, she made a little deal.
She prayed the manner of praying, but then the text of it doesn't seem like she didn't. I don't think she changed the text. But the manner of praying, absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely
she changed it. I think that she 100% made it more personal.
That's a woman for you. I mean, the baseline, we're all kind of conceived by men, so maybe is it possible there's a difference for how women pray and get right to the heart of it?
Definitely. I don't know if it's a men versus women, but certainly Hannah had a very significant effect on the way davening works, 100%.
I thought she changed it, kind of revolutionized it in a way.
She did, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, absolutely she did. She's an amazing character. Amazing person.
But I think what Trudy said is very important, because sometimes when you're saying your own personal prayer that's not formatted, it has a special meaning for you. So
I agree. It's not so simple. Like I can spend the whole class on this. This is why I'm not trying to diminish the question. Like it's a really great question. If anything, having the standard text feels very stifling. It's very, very difficult. 100%. I don't mean to diminish that. The reason it is standardized, it has certain goals. Goals of unity that the entire congregation, because part of prayer is you're praying alone, but you're also praying as part of a community. You're praying with everyone else. And so part of doing that is not just standing in the same room as everyone, but also reciting the same words. Even if when you recite the words, you're thinking of, you know, your story, and the person next to you is thinking about, you know, her story. But that fact that each of them are saying the same words really creates that unity, so that you're not just praying for yourself, but you're praying for everyone. That's why the prayer is also written in plural, you know, for that type of reason of you're praying for everyone, not just for yourself. There's a lot of good reasons for why it's standardized. It's certainly not, you know, an easy topic. I'm trying to, like, you know, respond in 2 minutes, a question that really deserves, you know, classes, hours of discussion. I hope I'm giving some response. I can give more, but I can't speak about what I wanted to talk about if I did talk about it, because it's such a worthwhile question. Yeah.
The thing that one can't be always creative.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'd find yourself being even duller than some of the prayers that you seem to feel you're reading that are not. You can't think of a way to express it, or not everybody can always. We're not all poets.
Yeah, that's what I meant by baseline. I think there are some days that all of us feel like we really have a prayer like gushing out of us.
Yes.
It's like something in our lives happened that just we need to pray about. Something bad, something good, we have to pray about. But most days, I think for most of us, I don't really have like a language of what I want to say to God. Like, I'm just not feeling it today. You know, I kind of want to go back to bed. So, you know, I don't really have like a particular feeling today. So having that baseline, so to speak, kind of, I don't know if forces is the right word, but it kind of gives you a basic text of what to recite, to which you can add on your own personal text, like Tehillim, or recite your add on your own emotions and gestures and the like. So that's regard to prayer. What I wanted to say with regard to korbanot, let's go back to sacrifices, which I think is the basis.
It's harder for us to imagine what it meant.
Yeah,
what it
absolutely. Very difficult. But this is a little bit what I want for the class to be doing, one of the offerings. And so first analogy I gave was type of prayers or different types of prayers. The second analogy I want to give is that ultimately sacrifices are not solely prayers. Nowadays, when we think of speaking to God or, you know, praying to God, we think of words. That's what we really focus on, is the way that we speak. But for anyone who's ever, you know, studied relationships, then you know that there are other forms of, you know, for example, there, I don't remember who the, which the scientist is, but there's a very famous scientist that's a paradigm that many, you know, relationships use, would call the five love languages. The five different ways that affection is demonstrated from one person to another. And only one of them is verbal. There are other forms of communication. There's physical touching, there's gift giving, there's time spent together, and there's a fourth one and a fifth one I'm blinking out now. But there's another one.
We'll come to you.
We'll come back to me. Yeah. That's Mindy. She would know. I don't remember the fifth one, but I'm blinking out right now. But either way, there are different types of things you can do, and that's true. You know, we all know that, you know, there are different ways of showing affection, and this is just a romantic sense. This is true for, you know, friendships. You know, I think we all know that physical contact is important over COVID. I think we all read those articles about, you know, not getting hugs from your friends was certainly very effective, made a big difference. You know, physical contact, spending time together. All these different things are different ways of creating, you know, communication in a relationship between individuals or between man and God. And so when it comes to korbanot, I want you to think a little bit of korbanot as different types of gift gestures. I'll give you just an analogy to it. I can come home one day and I can give my wife a bunch of different types of things. I can give her flowers. I can give her different types of flowers. Like one day I can give her sunflowers, which are her favorite, or I can give her roses. I could give her, you know, I could get her like a, you know, a nice jewelry thing of jewelry. I can get her a box of chocolates. I can give her different types of gifts. And ultimately, though, if you think about it, it's subtle. But they're not all the same type of gift, not just in terms of the price of them, which certainly has some, you know, the price certainly has some effect, but they mean different things, right? You know, even roses are not the same thing. They clearly have a certain social connotation that giving someone different types of flowers has, right? Or, you know, I'll give you another example. If a man, you know, and a woman are, you know, standing in a park and all of a sudden you see the man drop on one knee and pull out a ring, and the woman starts crying, man hasn't said anything yet, and yet we all know that there's something, you know, very significant that's about to happen. It's because the gesture in of itself, you know, is important and has a certain language to it, even though you haven't said any words. So I think the same thing is true by korbanot. And if you begin the korbanot, what you see is, let's say by korbanot nedavah, the korbanot are split up into a few different categories. I want to talk today specifically about korbanot nedavah, which are voluntary offerings. Offerings that you're not mandated to give, not because you sinned, not because you did anything wrong, but because for whatever reason, you feel, I want to communicate with God. And we're told as follows. If you want to take a look, turn to page 544. This is the very beginning of Vayikra. I think there's some more mashim in the, if someone wants to get them in the pantry there.
Is a sin offering similar to paying a fine?
In some ways, it might be.
That if you do something wrong and you...
Yeah, it might be a little bit. But take a look. This is the Parsha begins with the following statement. This is being 544, very beginning of Parsha Vayikra. Vayikra el Moshe, Vaydeber Hashem elav me'oel mo'ed le'mor. God spoke to Moshe and said to him from the tent of the meeting, Daber el b'nei Yisrael, speak to b'nei Yisrael ve'amarta alehem, and tell them, Adam ki akriv mikem korban la'ashem. When a person wants to offer a sacrifice to God, min ha-behima, min ha-bakar, u-min ha-tzon, takruvet korbanchem. From the cattle, from the flock, from various different animals, you can offer your korbanot. And then, I'm not going to read it inside because the Torah begins to go through the very specific details. The Torah describes when it comes to an ola. Ola is perhaps what you call maybe the purest of offerings, an offering where it's the whole animal is offered to God. And in this offering, the Torah describes the first next few verses. I'm not going to read it inside, but I'm just going to summarize kind of the bullet points. But the next few verses, focus about im ola korbano min habakar. If you want to offer a sacrifice from bakar, from cattle, right, from cows, right, you want to offer a bull. This is how the offering would be offered. Then the Torah continues and says v'im min hatzon korbano. If you want to offer a sacrifice from sheep. Right, you don't want to offer a bull, you rather want to offer a sheep. And then the Torah continues and says, this is verse 14, v'im min ha'oth, if you want to offer from birds, if you want to offer, you know, a dove, or a pigeon, if that's what you want to offer, this is how it would be offered. Now, the details, you know, get very technical, but it's interesting to note, I mean, I don't know if you have to, you know, ask yourself this question, Why would I pick one or the other? Right? Imagine yourself, one day you're coming to the Beit HaMikdash, and in front of the Beit HaMikdash, they used to have, you can actually see these like ruins in the old city if you've ever walked. You can actually kind of see where they used to have the old marketplace. And within that old marketplace, you can actually see a bunch of different, you know, the tour guides are creative to kind of tell you, like, oh, here's the type of stores they would have, here's the mikvah they would have, the ritual purity, here's the different things they would have. And so one of the things you do in Jerusalem on your way up to the Temple Mount would be to buy the sacrifice that you wanted. And let's say, for instance, you're a novice. You don't know so much about different sacrifices. So you go up you're on your way to the Temple Mount, and you stop by at the Walmart of animal sacrifices. And there's a helpful clerk who comes up to you and says, "Hey, do you want to offer a sacrifice? What type of sacrifice are you offering?" And you say, I don't know sacrifices. You know, what do I do?" So they tell you, "Well, is this sacrifice voluntary or is this sacrifice mandatory for a sin?" Let's say you answer voluntary. So then the clerk will say to you, okay, well, now you have three options of voluntary sacrifices. You can bring there are more than three, but I'm simplifying. The clerk will say you have three different types of animals that you can offer. You can offer from a bull, you can offer from a sheep, and you can offer from a dove. Which of the three would you like to choose? Now, the Torah just describes it as these three. And so you might say, well, I'm looking at my wallet, and the price of one, you know, is much cheaper than the other. That might affect my choice. Mm-hmm. That's true on one end. But what I want to suggest today is it's not just about your wallet. It's not just about how much money you can spend. Because I think the gesture is different. Just as the same way, if I go to a florist and I'm buying flowers for my spouse, well, different flowers might mean different things. Different gifts might mean different types of things. So what I want to talk about today, we don't have time to talk about all the korbanot because that would take a lot longer. I want to talk about one specific korban and the gesture that it means through its particular offering. Yeah?
I didn't see it in the other one, but just looking at this, for the bull,
it talks
about the papyrus to atone for him.
Yeah.
I see that for the other ones, and I'm wondering if that's a specific element of the bull offering that's different from the other ones.
Yes, it is. And great question. I won't talk about the a lot of par, but it certainly does make a difference. 100%. Good. It's a very good good thing to notice. Yeah. But I don't want to talk about it today, so I'm gonna stop. But I can talk about it a little bit later. But it is it's a good point. What I want to talk about today is maybe you've heard 15 shirim on this. I'm a little bit doubtful, but I want to talk about something you probably have not heard too much about, olat ha'of, the offering of the birds, which is specifically the dove or turtle dove. So take a look at the verse. Let's take a look at the verses. And what we're going to do is as follows. I'm going to focus for part of this shiur on some of the more technical details. But the purpose of the shiur is not for you to come out with, oh, here's how I would offer a turtle dove. Like, that's not my goal here. The goal here is to look at the technical details, and through the differences in the way that the offering was presented, maybe we can get some type of indication, not just of how the offering was given, but what type of gesture were you trying to convey if you offered this type of sacrifice, right? If you were that person in front of the clerk, and the clerk said, you have the option of offering a dove, here's what he really meant. Here's what it means to offer a dove. This is this type of sacrifice. This is if you have this type of gesture. So what is that blank? What is that, you know, fill in that blank? That's what I want to do today, and I'm going to do that through analyzing some of the close details of this sacrifice. Right, and I think, and I hope if this is clear, the goal here is not just to leave this shiur with like some knowledge about what some, you know, specific minutia of sacrifices back in the time of the temple, but it's really to get a sense of one of the ways that we approach God and one of the gestures that kind of fulfills that particular avenue of approaching God for this particular need or emotion. Okay, that's the goal of today. Sound good? Okay, so let's take a look at the oath. So it begins with verse 14, so page 548. So as I said, this is going to be rather technical. I'm going to translate. It is rather technical, so please bear with me. V'im min ha'of olah korbano la'Hashem. If you offer your sacrifice, if you wish to offer your olah, your burnt offering from a bird. V'kriv min ha'torim un min b'nei ha'yonah korbano. then you must give the offering, the burnt offering, from a dove or a type of turtle dove, a smaller dove. And here's how the offering would be given. The Kohen will take the bird and bring it toward the Mizbeach. Umalakit Rosho. And what will the Kohen do? The Kohen will slice off its head. I know this is a little gruesome. I apologize for the dynamic. This is just the unfortunately the reality of offering sacrifices. V'ikdir ha-mizbecha, he will then offer the head to them on the mizbeach. V'nimsad damo, and he will smear the blood al-kir ha-mizbeach on the wall of the altar. V'hisir et murato benotzata, he will remove its feathers. V'ishlich ota etzel ha-mizbeach kedma el mekom hadashen, and throw away the feathers to the garbage. V'shisauto v'ichnafav lo yavdil. Then the Kohen will split it apart, but he won't completely sever off its wings. V'shiktiyoto akohen al mizbecha, and the Kohen will offer it on the mizbeach al ha'itzim asher hala'esh, on top of the wood which is by the fire. Olahu, this is an ola, an elevation offering. Ishei reach nichoach la'Hashem, a satisfying aroma for God. That's the verses. It's rather technical, a little bit, you know, for modern readers, a little gruesome. Yeah, and some of the details here.
Why would Hashem want one of its animals that he created to be killed that way and offered as an elevation, as a sacrifice?
It's a great question. It's kind of the same question, I think, in terms of why would God create animals and then allow people to eat them? It's a very big question in terms of how we understand our relationship with animals. I don't have a very quick answer. This is another long, good question, but it's a great question. And it's certainly something where, as modern people, we feel very, you know, strange. Even if you're not a vegetarian, I think you feel strange about just offering animals as sacrifices. It feels a little cruel. Yeah, cruel. Yes. And, yeah, maybe like backwards, you know. It seems, yeah, barbaric. So I'm going to pause on the question, but it is a real question to answer. It's just not our topic for today. But I want to talk about the Olat Ha'oth, some of the details here. And I know all that, bear in mind, I'm not pretending these are not real questions. But I want to focus on some of the details. And what I want to do is, these are a little bit technical, but I want to use these technicalities to really, you know, push us forward into really understanding what type of gesture was an Olat Ha'oth. So I want to point out a few things that are different about Olat Ha'oth from the other offerings. First off, the dove, right, it's a lot smaller, and presumably it's a lot cheaper than, you know, the other offerings. But it's not just about the wallet. I don't want to focus only on the money, because the money is part of it, but it's not the only part of the question here. There are other things that are different about the way the dove is offered. Number one, how is the dove slaughtered? What's the word that's used?
Cut off his head.
Yeah, umalak. It means to cut off the head. The way it is, and this is, I apologize for the gruesome nature, but I just to describe it, the way that it was done in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, the Kohen would hold on to the bird with his, you know, grasp onto it, and use their thumb, which I guess they hadn't, you know, cut their nails, and they would use the nail on their thumb to slice its neck. That's the way that, I know it's a little bit gruesome, but that's the way it would be done. As opposed to, how would the animals be slaughtered? What's the word that's used for it? What's the word that in Hebrew used for slaughtering animals?
Shachat.
Shachat. And what's shachat? Shachat is similar to actually the way we do shchita nowadays. What do you do for shchita? You take a knife
and you
cut its throat, yeah. Right? So they're both, you know, similar in terms of they're killing animals, but they're a little bit different, right? And they're, you know, and you could say maybe you don't need to have a difference. Maybe there's no need for a knife, you know, when it comes to a bird, because a bird is much smaller and it can be held in your hands. But it seems like that might be significant already, that there's some, that the manner of killing the bird is a bit different than the way that we kill.
Are we as concerned with getting the blood out of the bird as we are of getting the blood out of the animal?
So that's a great, great point. Because it actually seems that the role of the blood is actually different between the various sacrifices. And why it matters so much that the blood is different is because, and I know I'm going to keep saying this because I know it's hard, but sacrifices are very technical, so it's like something we don't always relate to. But in the world of sacrifices, the world of korbanot, what is the most important thing that you're offering?
The blood.
The blood is the most important thing. Why?
The blood.
Ki adam hu hanefesh. The blood is considered to be the life force of, you know, a person, of the animal. And if you want to imagine, I think the Ramban is kind of the best
That's
way of really picturing
it.
That's why we don't eat it. It's why in our connotations, I think the Ramban's formulation is often the easiest way to understand it. The Ramban makes the argument that what is a sacrifice? A sacrifice is a form of replacement for my own, you know, donation of my body, so to speak, to God. Right? I should be offering of myself. I, you know, deserve to die because God has given me great things or because I've done something wrong to God. Instead, I offer a sacrifice, and that sacrifice is meant to, you know, represent me and all of my humanity. And so the way that we really focus on it is really focusing on the life force of the animal, which is the blood. So the blood actually plays this crucial role in the sacrifice. It's not just in terms of the ideology, but even the terminology, the language, and the procedure of killing the animal. The blood is the primary discussion of the sacrifice. And if you've ever learned Mishnayot, Zvachim, and Achot, or the like, most of the time is actually focusing on details of what you do with the blood. And it's why in the Beit HaMikdash on Yom Kippur, part of the prayer is that we say the Kohen goes in front of the Aron, right? And he sprinkles, you know, once on top, seven times below, right? That's what we repeat in prayer. Achat, achat v'achat, achat v'shtayim, achat v'shalosh. If you know what I'm talking, if you remember from Yom Kippur, right? It's very much focused on the blood. Surprisingly then, if we come back to the Olat Ta'of, the role of the blood here is rather minimal. We hear that the blood is, well, there is a verse. Verse 15 says, "V'nimsa damo al kir ha-mizbeach." The blood is kind of smeared or pressed against the altar. The Kohen will literally take the body of the animal and kind of smush it, push it against the altar. That's the way it would be done. But if you compare that to the way that the other, I'm gonna read inside, I don't have to follow along, but if you compare that to some of the language that the Torah uses for the other offerings, it's rather shocking in its discrepancy. When it came, for instance, to the sheep, and you don't have to follow along, I'm just gonna read it out, we're told, Vizarku b'nei Aron ha-Kohanim et damo mizbeach saviv, the blood would be thrown onto the altar. Right? There's almost a whole verse dedicated to the blood and throwing it onto the altar. And then we talk about burying the blood and all sorts of things that the blood is talked about. And it's not only what's interesting that the blood is minimized when it comes to this offering. It's also interesting in terms of the priorities of what happens. Take a close look at verse 15. Again, I'm going through the technical details here. I promise if this is, you know, if it's too technical, we will get to the more...
The volume is so different.
The what?
The volume.
Yes.
I mean, a bird will have a small, relatively small amount of blood that can be handled differently than a whole cow.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to say that again. Sheep. That the when it comes to some of these differences, some of them just come from the very nature of, you know, the size of the animals.
I mean, if we were sacrificing mice, let us say, it might come out more like birds.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with you. But I think from a perspective, not only of, but at the end of the day, you are choosing this animal. And the way that it is actually performed, I think, makes a difference. And the way that the blood, because you're right that the blood is not so much, but you could have sprinkled the blood. There's not a lot of blood there, but you could collect a little bit of blood and sprinkle it onto the mizbeach. Mm. It wouldn't be as much, but you still could do it with a bird. It's not, you know, unheard of.
No.
So you could have done it. And also take a look at the way that the Torah describes this verse. Take a look at verse 15. Here's the order. Pay attention to the order of what the steps. And as I said, it is a bit gruesome. If it is too much, feel free to space out, then we'll come back and gather you, you know, as we come back. First is as follows. The Kohen will bring the bird towards the Mizbeach. So the first step is the bird is still alive. You're bringing it towards the Mizbeach. Number two, Malak et Rosho. You will slice off its head with a thumb, as we described earlier. V'hiktir ha-Mizbecha. And you will offer the head on the Mizbeach. And number four, you will smear the blood on the wall of the Mizbeach. In terms of the order, right, what would be the order you expect? Let's say it this way. Other offerings, what's the order of the offering? Here's the order. You slaughter the animal, you collect the blood, you sprinkle the blood, and then, after that, after you've brought the blood to the Mizbeach, you've offered the blood, only then, what do? You then prepare the animal for the burning, for the things that need to be offered on the Mizbeach.
Well, this again is a quantity matter.
But it's not just quantity, because here you also you could, the order could have been the same. It could have been the same way here. But here it's not just the order, the quantity, but the order actually in the psukim appears different.
Well, the point is with the bird, it's a small amount, it's a relatively small mess, it's a relatively thing.
Sure, but
if you cut the throat of a cow or even a sheep or any other such animal, I have never been there, but it's a tremendous gush. Everything gets flooded with this.
But if anything, I think that would. If anything, that would. If the goal of the sacrifice is to collect the blood, then what do I want to do right after killing the animal? The first thing is collect the blood. So that's what we do with sheep. That's what we do with bulls, with other animals. What do we do with birds? Well, the pasuk here says, the first thing you do is you offer the head on the mizbeach. It means that just in terms of timing, right? You cut off the animal head. And then you spend, you know, the 120 seconds, you know, bringing the animal's head up to the mizbeach and offering it before you go back to the body and then collecting the blood, right? That takes time. And as you said, there isn't much blood to begin with, so you're losing a lot of blood, which is a rather surprising thing if blood is so important. So it's not just that you're right that there's less blood, which is an inherent property, but it's also we seem to be diminishing the role of the blood here. And take a look, for instance, so this is the way the verse is written. If you take a look at Rashi, Rashi is still in the verse, I know you guys have it on the bottom, it's in the, you know, the Rashi script. I'll read it, feel free, I'll translate it, I promise, but if you want to follow along, it's it's the very last one on verse 15, from Umalak v'Ktir v'Dimsat, so on the right column, in the kind of the middle there, if you want to follow along, and I'll translate. If Shalom Arkane, me'akar shu maktir hu motzeh, Rashi asks a question, which may be the question you would all ask, which is, how is this possible? How is it possible that after you've already offered up the head, or really sounds like you're offering the whole animal, only then do you get the blood? That doesn't seem to be logical. Ella ma'akdar harosh be'atzmo ve'aguf be'atzmo af melika kein u'pshuto shel nikra misuras hu. Rather, instead, what do you have to do? The way to read this verse is to read it out of order. That the Torah writes it out of order. Umalak vihiktir. First, you're going to kill the animal, and then after you're going to, before you're going to offer the avikodim haktara v'nimsadam okvar. Before you offer the animal up as a sacrifice, you are supposed to collect the blood. Right? Rashi's objection here can be read almost as a technicality, which is kind of the objection I was making. It's just hard to get the blood otherwise. Like, you're going to miss it if you offer the animal first. But it's not just a technicality. There's also something about the precedence, about the way that what is most important, right? Usually, the things that are most important are the things that are done first. And so you'd expect that the blood is what is done first. And that's the way that I'm quoting here, but there's like the Ramban and others, they actually make that comment. But the problem of the blood is that the blood really should be first. It should be the first thing that we discuss that's the most important. And yet, despite that, the blood is not the first thing written here. The blood is only mentioned after it's already been offered. So the question I want to ask is why? Why are we intentionally diminishing the role of the blood when it comes to Olat Ta'uf, when it comes to the bird offering? That's question number. What's difference number one? I thought about some other differences, and I'll get to the theories and the more interesting part that I see more of us will be excited by. The second difference I want to talk about is part of every sacrifice. The difference number one was actually the way you kill the animal, was in terms of shechita versus melika, right? The way the killing of the animal is different. Number two is the role of the blood. Number three, when it comes to animal sacrifice, what do you do as part of sacrifice? If you take a look at the other verses, I'll read the verse and you guys can just follow along. If you want to take a look at... take a look, for instance, at... Let's talk about the Olat Korban. Turn to page 544. I want to point out two differences in this verse. Turn to page 544. We're going to look at the other Korban. We're going to look at the cattle, at the cows. Verse 3 says as follows. If you want to bring a burnt offering from a cattle, zachar tamim yakirvenu, you will bring a male bull which is unblemished, right? Doesn't have any blemishes. El petach ol moed yakrivotel, you will bring it to the front of the ol moed, of the tent of the meeting, v'yirtono lifnei Hashem, voluntarily before God. V'samach yado al rosh haolah, what is the first thing you will do after you bring the animal forward? You will place your hands on top of the animal's head, v'nirtzalo l'chaper alav, and you will, and it, that will make it acceptable as a form of atonement for God. So what is the first thing, or after you bring the animal forward, that you do? You do what's called smicha. You lean on top of the animal, right? You symbolically do some type of gesture, maybe a prayer with it, to demonstrate this animal is going to be in my stead. It is my sacrifice. And if you look at the other sacrifices, they all have this thing. They all have this same step of smicha, of leaning against the animal and making that statement. In fact, in the Avodat Yom HaKippurim, on Yom Kippur, and I keep referring to Yom Kippur because I hope it's like the one thing that we kind of follow a little bit longer because we pray about it more specifically, but the Kohen Gadol three times does a vidui and leans on top of the animal. That's the first time he says, Ana Hashem, Chatati, Aviti, Pashati, right? And that's when the people say, when they hear him say, Shem Hashem, the people bow down. That's when we all bow down. If you remember the place. So three times we do that because three times the Kohen Gadol leans against the animals and says, Avidui.
I don't see it with the sheep here. I mean, maybe the rabbis learned it by parallelism or something.
Yeah, I think it's later. I think you're right. I think it's later in Tzav. There they have it.
Okay.
It's a good point. They don't have it here. But certainly, they don't. The one exception to all this, it's a good point you're making. The one exception, the one real exception to it, especially, not just, I guess, you're right about this particular passage here, is what sacrifice do you not lean against, do you not have any smicha? The birds.
It's too small.
Now, of course, birds are too small. 100%, they're small. You can't really lean your whole body against a bird. But I could easily imagine myself putting a finger against the animal. You know, there are ways to do it. The symbolic act of showing this animal is instead of me, there are ways to do it, right? That symbolism should be there. Why am I skipping on this important step? And yet, for some reason, we don't have that step. That step is not mentioned. And this is true even not just in the psukim, but within rabbinic literature, the way that the verse was understood, you wouldn't actually do smicha with these animals. Not only would you not do smicha, but I'll say one other difference. You may have noticed that when it came to the par, and this is true about every other animal, what is the requirement of the animal, right? You go to the you know, the Walmart of they go to the warehouse of buying all the different animals, and
unblemished.
You want to make sure it's unblemished. Yes, you have to make sure, well, male or female, depending on the type. Yeah.
Well, I mean, for these.
For these, yeah. For these. Yeah. So I'm not going to talk about the gender because that's a whole other discussion. But when it comes to, I want to talk about the blemish. When it comes to these animals, intentionally we're told it has to be unblemished.
So
when
external and unblemished or internal?
Both, really. But in this
how
case,
do you know internal?
It's the way it would look or move. That's the way. But you're right, it's a good question about internal blemishes. That's a whole thing about trefot. How do you know about internal blemishes? And this is why half of kosher nowadays is about figuring out, is there an internal blemish in terms of the animal? Right. So there are all these questions.
You can also figure out afterwards. Oh, we did it wrong.
Yeah.
It's not good.
And then you check it. This is the way it's done nowadays often. Is that this is like modern kosher nowadays. What do? You take a cow. You kill the cow. What does the shochet do?
He looks at the lungs.
He looks at the lungs. Yes, exactly. And that's what glot.
That's an after the fact.
And actually, that's what glot kosher means. Glot kosher means that the lungs are very smooth. They don't have any ridges. So you do it. You would do it after the fact, which is why
doubt,
some trefot has to only.
If there's something doubtful, right? Essentially,
yeah.
Is it there?
Which is why it's long. There's a lot more discussed. But you're right that sometimes it's afterwards, and if it turns out that it was not treif, that it was treif, then you're kind of stuck with an animal now that you have to
do it again.
A carcass. Well, not just that, but you've kind of especially a cow is very expensive. Now you have to find a way to this is part of the modern cautious industry. What do? You sell it.
You sell it to the.
You sell them to the non-Jews, exactly. So it's like a little bit, you have to kind of, I actually remember very distinctly when I was in yeshiva, they wanted to show us shechita, and I will be honest, I mean, different people have different tolerances for it. I'm not grossed out by blood, but I can tell you I did not want to eat that animal. For me, it's very visceral to see the blood. I did not want to eat it personally. Mm-hmm. Some people are like, yes, lunch. I was just like, this is not my lunch, but I'm happy for you guys.
Yeah.
Turned out we had a whole thing. It was really interesting to see the details and how it goes.
Sometimes it would be difficult to eat a peanut butter sandwich after watching such a thing.
That's probably true, too. But the... But either way, that animal actually ended up being a trefa. Actually, for whatever reason, the animal was not kosher. So they ended up selling it to the local Arab who worked in the yeshiva. And they gave him to him because I guess it's still halal, so why not? So he had it. But either way, that is a question about trait vote. But it's interesting to note then, when it comes back to our point, birds were not told have to be perfect, has to be unblemished. Why not? Why of all things birds not unblemished? There are actually a few other differences, but I kind of want to stop here. I'll just repeat them again just for consolidation. Number one difference was the way that you kill the animal. Number two was the role of the blood. And that's really what we're going to talk about a lot, the role of the blood. Number three was smicha, whether you lean your body against the animal or you make some type of gesture about me, you're placing me with the animal. And number four was the fact that the animal does have to be perfect or not, unblemished. The bird is the one thing that do not need to be unblemished. The question is, they're all technical details. What do they represent? Do they tell us something significant about the bird and the way that this offering was given or what it meant?
How do we slaughter a chicken that we're going to eat?
Nowadays?
I mean, how is...
It's a knife.
I mean, the point is, when you slaughter a cow or you slit the throat quickly and so on, what do you do with the chicken? The same thing, cut the head off.
Yeah, it's actually a lot quicker for a chicken because it's a lot smaller.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the point. You could do it, or you can also more easily just cut a head off.
You can't use your finger.
But you can't.
Yeah, you don't use your finger. Yeah, no, it's not the same as the way it is in the Beit Mikdash. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is it possible the difference is because the bird flies? You said elevation offering. Bird flies is so radically different from all the other.
So it's interesting you say about flying. I do think it's something about the flight, but I don't think the fact that elevation, the other offerings are also elevations. But it is an interesting way of thinking about it. You're right, that already there's something about the flying that might be different. I'm going to go in a different direction, but, you know, if you have more thoughts on it, I'd love to hear, you know, your thoughts. I'm going to go in a different direction, though. I want to suggest two presentations, and I actually had sources, but I'm going to read it outside, because I'm actually at 311, 46, and I don't want to end this year later than usual. So I'm going to present two possibilities, and I think these possibilities are significant, and why I'm sharing them, not just because it's Torah and it's good to learn, because they actually have significance to the way that we approach God in our own lives. So the first presentation, the first suggestion, is way by Shimshon Rafael Hirsch. Rav Hirsch has a very long commentary, it's like almost 7 pages long. That's why I was a little bit late, because I was trying to make sure I read the whole thing before I got here, and I didn't realize how long it was. But I wanted to make sure I read the whole thing in totality. And Rav Hirsch makes the following suggestion. He says he reads through the whole thing. He says he goes through all the details, the differences. And then he says, what's the key to understanding why this offering is different, why all these details are different? To best understand the differences, you have to study what type of animal is being offered. And the bird in Tanakh is typically associated with one action. It's not always true, but this is the way he presents it. The birds often are associated with an action of
flies.
Well, no, yes, but flying, but not just flying, but in terms of, I guess, more
peace. What about peace?
Peace is kind of the modern connotation, but in terms of what they're doing, the language is often that they're fleeing. There's some type of language of birds fleeing, like a human being. You can imagine, like, when humans come, right? The first thing the pigeon, you know, sees on the well, pigeons are rather stubborn in New York streets, but in theory, they see a car coming and they fly away. That's what we'd hope, as you know, we would hope that the pigeons do. Right? There's some type of element of them fly away. They run away. And Rav Hirsch argues that's what the bird offering is supposed to represent. It's this feeling of fear, not necessarily for your life, but for, you know, maybe your safety, maybe for some type of existential fear. And the way that the offering then exhibits itself is this very almost aggressive way of interacting with the animal. Think about the way that you're dealing, you kill the animal, right? I mean, they all feel like, for us, modern sense, they all feel a bit aggressive. But just imagine the difference between killing an animal. This is the way that you'd kill, you know, how you kill a sheep. Well, you gently put the sheep down on the floor, and then you take a knife and you cut its throat. As opposed to a bird, what do? Well, you hold on to it with your hand, and you
scratch its head off.
You take your thumb and you swipe off its head. I know they both, you might not feel it, but I think there's like one that sounds like a lot more aggressive. Like I'm grabbing onto the animal. There's something a lot more active and aggressive in the way that you're doing this.
But again, size makes a difference.
Size makes a difference. But it's not just about the size. There's something about, this is the way, well, I think anything my size might help. I don't think he says this, but I think it fits well. If you feel like you're scared, you're terrified, what do you feel usually? You feel small. Mm-hmm. You feel like you're not big, which perhaps might fit actually pretty well in, that you're picking a small animal that really represents what you're doing and who you are at that moment. And many of the details of the offering, of Hirsch argues, really fit within this type of sacrifice. Why is it that when it comes to the bird offering, the bird doesn't have to be perfect? Well, when you're feeling afraid, perfection is the last thing on your mind, right? You just want, you know, you don't feel perfect yourself. You feel like you're lacking something. You're lacking strength. You're lacking some type of protection. So that's why there's no, there's not to be perfect. What about the leaning, in terms of why is there no smicha? Rav Hirsch argues there's no smicha because the whole goal of the sacrifice is supposed to feel a bit more rushed. It's supposed to feel like it's a lot quicker. Like it gets, you know, it's not a 3-hour long minyan, but it's a nice Israeli 45-minute, quick and done. It's supposed to feel rushed. It's supposed to feel like you're running through this process and you don't have time to do some of the other parts of this sacrifice. And so Rav Hirsch argues that the way that this sacrifice comes is it's really meant to be this sacrifice of feeling terrorized, feeling that you personally are being attacked in some way and that you need God's protection. And that's why the sacrifice has these details. So, in other words, if I were to bring us back to the analogy I gave to begin with, you're going to the Beit HaMikdash, you stop by at the Shuk, at the local, warehouse, you're buying an offering, they say, what type of offering do you want? And you say, you know what, I don't know what type of offering I want, but I'll tell you what I'm feeling right now. I'm feeling scared. I'm feeling like I need protection. I'm feeling like, there's rising anti-Semitism. I feel like my job is in peril. I feel like there's something in my family, my children, something is happening with them. I'm feeling that, I could give up. My marriage is falling apart. I'm feeling, that the world is crumbling around me. I'm feeling the sense of terror. At that moment, the clerk would tell you know what? I have the great offering for you. Offer a bird. The bird is the best gesture that fits in this emotional response. And I think we all have the sense in tefillah, also in davening, we have that same, sometimes it does happen for us. Hopefully it doesn't, because it's, not a great emotion to have. But unfortunately, as life passes, we all have encountered that feeling. And if we lived in time of the Beit HaMikdash, this is the sacrifice that we would use to exhibit that feeling to God. Nowadays we have to replace it, through tefillah, but this is kind of one way of looking at way related to God. So that's one theory, one explanation of what this offering was meant to be. Yeah.
So technical, but maybe not technical point. I always had the impression, and this makes it more aggressive, so I don't know if my impression is correct. I had the impression that when you do Malika, you take your nail and you stick it in and cut the animal's.
I always thought it was a slice.
As opposed to a slice.
So I thought it was a slice, but I could be wrong. You could be right that it might be.
That's even more aggressive.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I have to look that up. I don't know. But you're right, it will be even more aggressive. It'd be interesting. I don't know the difference in that degree. So that's kind of one theory. I want to suggest a second theory. This is a theory that Professor Yoni Grossman, who has a very, very amazing book on called Torah Takorbanot. It's in Hebrew. It really has to be translated to English because it's the book that I think really... I love Rabbi Grossman, but if there's one thing that I think he'll remember more than anything else, it might be his book on Korbanot because it's... a genre in and of itself. It's like a whole... He opens up Korbanot in a way that no one else does. And so he has a different suggestion. And his suggestion, I think, is a fascinating suggestion. He argues that we really need to focus on the difference about the blood. Because at the end of the day, the core, the blood is the primary difference between this offering and the other offerings. Yes, it's true, it's smaller. And yes, it's true, technically, the bird has less blood. But as I pointed out, the verse also seems to minimize the role of the blood by placing it second, out of order, Rashi says, right? We're really trying to minimize the role of the blood. And even the blood that's offered is offered passively. It's not a very primary role. We could have sprinkled blood for the bird, and yet we don't. So what does that represent? So he makes the following suggestion. If I offer an animal and I focus on the blood, right, I'm offering blood as the main part of my sacrifice, then I'm offering, the life force of the blood. In other words, I'm suggesting that there's some life force for the animal. If I'm focusing, though, on an animal that doesn't have a lot of blood, right, both naturally and physically, I'm actually, the way I'm actually expressing this sacrifice is I'm minimizing the role of blood. What am I sacrificing?
Body.
Not the blood, but the body. The very physical body. And yes, it's true, birds are not so big, but I'm really focusing a lot on the physical body of the animal. And where Yoni Grossman suggests is, what type of offering is this? This is an offering where you feel that you're speaking to God about the physical body. If I have something that I feel that I want to relate to God about my body, and it could be in a few different ways. I could offer about my body because I'm sick, right? My leg is hurting me, or, you know, I'm having, you know, I have arthritis, or all sorts of, you know, body aches. And I want to somehow express in type of prayer to God, please, like, I want my body. I want something, it feels very physical. It's not some emotional thing. It's very, very physical. God, please respond to my, you know, calls. Then I offer a bird offering. Because the bird is this very physical offering, the sense of very, you know, we're closing the focusing on the body. And it's not just about pain. I think it could also be in a situation where, you know, you feel like you did something wrong with your body. I feel like, you know, oftentimes we do something wrong, you know, if we feel guilty about something. So we do something wrong with our minds, with our heads, with our tongues, or we said the wrong thing, we did the wrong thing. But sometimes it can feel that we did something, you know, physically wrong. Sometimes
I
it feels like
somebody in the nose.
Yeah, it could be, and that's actually a great example, right? I did something when I was angry, and so you could be upset that you were angry. That could be its own, you know, kapara. You need atonement for being angry, and you know. But there's also a certain sense. Maybe I acted aggressively, you know, in a workplace or you know, at home when I shouldn't have, and so you feel bad not only about you know your emotional response, but you really feel bad about the way that your physical body was used. Because your body shouldn't be used in this way. Because you feel like, you know, punching someone is not the response that I want my body to be doing in this type of situation.
Or taking cocaine or something.
Yeah, or taking something very, if you feel like you did something that has very clear physical effects, right? Cocaine, something like that could be something that you feel more, you know, emotional. But certainly, if it feels very physical to you, and this is why it's personal, right? You know, two people could have different responses to this type of, you know, the same sin or the same type of, you know, action. But I think if you yourself, as an individual, feel that I need to present my atonement or my prayer to God as a physical act, I need to present something about my physicality, because we're not just souls and, you know, spirits and minds. We also have a body, and our body plays a large role in who we are and what we do in this world. And so if I want to offer to God my body in some ways, so then what would the clerk tell you? Don't offer a bull. Don't offer a sheep. Offer a bird. Use the bird sacrifice, because the bird sacrifice is a very physical sacrifice where the emphasis is not on the blood, but rather is on the body of the bird.
So would you suppose you're a soldier in the war?
Yeah.
And a soldier in the war, I mean, they're defending themselves, they're defending their country, whatever it is, but they kill somebody. Was there a sense that maybe you should make a bird offering because you killed an enemy soldier?
So, in terms of whether
you have such a blessed thing that you're doing to,
So I don't know in terms of responding to specific, you know, is there a sin in killing war? It's a whole big discussion.
Yeah.
The morality of war, it's you know, almost larger than the tefillah question.
Spanking a child.
Corporal punishment with her children is also a very big question.
Yes.
I'm not pro in Dowdy for sure, but
I'm thinking of these things.
Yeah.
Where you do some physical thing, you expect praise for it. But you're still doing your harm to some, but other.
Yeah, so in terms of the specifics of whether a specific action mandates kapara, requires atonement, I'm going to leave that to another
you're
time.
Writing a book about it, right?
Okay.
5 books at this point. Mm-hmm. From this one class, yeah.
So what happens nowadays when we don't have these physical.
So nowadays we try our best with prayer. But I think we do, you know, this is kind of what we do on Yom Kippur. We talk, first of all, the Vidui, if you notice, actually tries going through the different types of things. And some of the Vidui are very physical, not just in terms of your action, you know, actually, you know, Chatati, Aviti, Pashati, you're doing something physical. But we actually talk about the physicality of I did a sin with my body, with my limbs. We actually do talk about that. But I actually think, you know, it's a little bit personal. This is why I think this is one of the things that Korbanot really opens your mind to. It can feel personal. And for some people, maybe prayer is the way you respond to things. But maybe you feel that, you know what, prayer doesn't feel like it's enough. I want to do something else. I feel bad because I did something wrong with my body. So what do? Well, I would recommend find something with your body that you feel atones for your sin. What could that be? Well, there are a lot of things that relate to chesed that have to do with your physical body. A lot of, you know, schlepping things. You know, you could get someone groceries who needs groceries. You could, you know, help. You could move objects. You could do all sorts of things that involve your physical body in terms of, you know, other examples I could think of. But your body could certainly be used as a means, a mechanism of repairing the way that you see yourself.
Participate in the food drive.
Food drive, yeah. You could run for chesed. And if you ever run a marathon, I promise you, I mean, unless you're really fit, you feel your body by the end. Right? You can feel, you know, there's all sorts of things that you do that you feel your physical body as part of this, you know, sacrifice to God or prayer to God. So I think kind of if I were to summarize, at the end of the day, you know, we don't offer sacrifice. We don't have this. But I think we do ourselves a disservice by not noticing the details here. Because if we just look at the technicalities, yeah, it feels technical. It feels, you know, some people love kachin. Most people feels very technical and unrelatable. But if you look at the details and care about what type of gesture am I offering God, if I was going to the warehouse or, you know, whatever it is, and asking for an animal, and the clerk said, here are your options, what do the options represent? And so what I suggested today was that when it came to the bird offering, there might be two theories as to what the bird represents. Theory number one, Samson Farr Hirsch suggests, the bird offering presents a feeling of terror, of being afraid, being physically afraid or being terrorized by something emotional.
Vulnerability,
yes. And therefore, I take a bird offering that often flies away, something which is small and diminutive by nature, something which I don't lean on. I don't do all of these processes because I want to rush through the process. And the act of killing the bird is a very physical and aggressive act, because I want to almost symbolize the way that I feel like I'm being aggressively opposed.
You're also not donating. You're not doing this to, say, an eagle or some huge aggressive bird.
You're doing it to a small little dove, yeah. You're doing it to a very small, almost defenseless bird, right? That really represents, I think, who you are. That's one theory, and I think that's one type of way that we represent, like, when we speak to God. There's the other theory, Yoni Grossman's theory, where he suggests the purpose of the bird offering is, and he focuses really on the role of the blood, as opposed to other offerings where we focus on blood, and blood is the life force of the animal, meant to represent our life force. When it comes to a bird, there is no blood, or very little blood, because what we really want to emphasize is not the life force, but rather the physical body. If we want to focus our prayers, our thoughts, not on the way that our emotions, our personality is affected, but our physical body, very physicality of what we've done wrong, of what we pray for, what we're asking for forgiveness, what we're asking for God to heal. If we're focusing on that, we bring a bird offering, because the bird offering focuses our energies and focuses our prayers on the physical body, our physical blemishes, and the need. That's why it's blemished. That for the need, therefore, for a kapara of some sort through a physical animal like the bird offering.
Cool.
So I hope this gave a little bit of insight into some of the different sacrifices.
Very nice.
And
Smith and I talk about it here.